Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
I'm talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamal. Ricky Garcia on the board. SP Futures down 19. NASDAQ Futures down 86. We've come back a little bit. Dow Futures down 230. Do we have Professor Carl?
You do.
Anybody can be a professor these days. You, me, you know, heck, we'll just...
Well, I, you know what? I think my cat's a professor.
Well, could very well be. Professor among cats, you know.
It's a Professor Purrs.
Well,
I could use another P word, but, you know, where
I know. So. I know. We don't want to do that. The, what, what, you know, I, just when you think things can't get any worse, I come in today, and I'm looking at what is the story with this Trump family crypto that's got people involved with North Korea and stuff? What is going on with these people?
You know, I haven't dug into that one.
I haven't either. I'm looking at it, and there's a probe from somebody. Why do we have a president's family running a crypto operation in the first place? What are we doing?
Well, you know, it's what I think is rather amusing is that if you recall,
yeah,
you know, that SPAC that ended up as DJT on the exchange,
yep,
right? That
trading $10 now, but it's $10.75.
Yeah, you know, don't you remember, Chief, that you were all up in arms about this thing was trading, you know, like what $35 or $40 or something,
yep,
like this. And you know, it's terrible. The president, yeah. Well, guess what? The market has this really funny way of saying to people that do stuff like that, you know, it, eventually there has to actually be a path to, you know, to something that makes sense. Eventually, and maybe not tomorrow, but
that's when you decide to IPO it, because then you need to get your cash up front. Well, usually you can't sell it right away.
Well, they kind of sort of, you know, that the whole idea with the SPAC is to get around the regulations that mean that at least you have to publish something. I mean, it is called a red herring for a reason, but at least you have to publish an S-1. And, you know, and let people have a little bit of a look under the kimono and see if there's anything under there. You know, that didn't stop people from being completely stupid in the 1990s, but, you know, at least there was some warning. What I find fascinating is I have been banging the drum on this since the Russia-Ukraine thing started, and the you know, the administration's response to that was slam anybody's fingers in the door that had anything even peripherally connected to Russia, even if the thing was an American citizen who happened to own a exchange-listed fund traded in the United States. Okay?
Yeah.
So, by the way, I had a small position in one of those, which got forced liquidated at, you know, 5 cents on what it was worth before they blackballed you from transacting in it and then forced liquidated it. All right? So, essentially, the federal government stole the value of what I had in that position. They confiscated it for all intents and purposes.
And then who knows? You know that the stuff.
Well,
those
somebody got it.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody got it because, you know, money.
Well, if it just drops in. Well, it depends. I mean, if somebody.
Well, no, the companies that were in that fund did not go away.
Did the fund actually have the stock, or were they some kind of futures deals or something?
No, they actually had the stock.
Well, somebody's got it. You're right. Somebody has to have that.
Somebody has it, but whoever it is, it isn't anyone.
It isn't
anyone.
You.
it isn't me, and it isn't all the other people who held it, right? And, ultimately, like a year and a half later, I get this small cash out from, the liquidation of it as it was, after all the money had been stolen, basically. You know, there's a little bit left. We can't quite steal all of it. There's, there's 10 cents on the dollar left that gets distributed out. Okay. All right, that goes into the loss carry forward bucket, and it'll eventually get absorbed. But the thing is this. When that started, I pointed out that this was a secular change that was not going to be reversible, that it had essentially destroyed even though it isn't really seigniorage, it worked exactly the same way economically as seigniorage in regards to the United States and our deficit spending and the impact on inflation. That was permanently gone. That we did it to ourselves. And oh, by the way, at the time, over the previous 10 years, just based on the increase in goods, international goods transactions, that this was accruing a non-inflationary capacity to issue debt secured treasuries in the United States of almost $700 billion a year. Okay, now that is not a small amount.
No, it's not a small amount.
That is not a small amount of money. And that, oh, by the way, that's forever gone. And incidentally, when I first started talking about this, a couple months later, here comes the inflation during Biden's term in office. Okay. Go figure.
Well, I mean,
right?
The money supply went up 40% in 18 months.
Well, I get that. However, the spike itself from a consumer price perspective, and I get it, the money supply thing and everything else. However, the reality is that this has not gone away. And yet nobody understands that this is why that has gone away. So think about this. Hal's right in that, in his, how he calculates this out. All right. I mean, mathematics is mathematics.
Hal tries to make it overly complicated. The fact is, you pour money in the system, the prices go up.
Well,
it's that simple.
Yeah, yes, unless, and this is what we've done for the last 30, 40 years, unless somehow some of that gets sequestered off and therefore doesn't end
you
up
mean,
in
You mean if they put it in so fast, like during COVID, it can't be absorbed that quickly. All it means is it takes more than 6 months. It'll take a year, year and a half to come through.
Well, except that, again... If I can take if $700 billion a year of it is held out of circulation, and it's from the increase, it's not from the volume of global trade, it's from the delta. If that is the case, as long as global trade continues to increase, and we're the currency in which those transactions are being held during that period of time that production is taking place and shipping and everything else, container ships take a while to get from one place to another, then that is essentially seigniorage in terms of economics.
Right, but why does everybody, just because, I mentioned this to my guys at the Federal Reserve when they actually were still here and when I gave a drink with them, now they don't come to work anymore, which is even more bizarre, but exchanges and Federal Reserve people don't come to work ever, it seems. But it's anyway, when you're a government agency and you make too much money, anyway, that's another horse, but I said, I think looking back at it, with the exception of a couple of times during, after the Civil War and something, this connection that everybody makes between deficit spending and inflation, even though it's been there for a long time, is not correct. You could deficit spend to your heart's content by just borrowing the money. That's why there's never, in my opinion, never in our lifetime, for sure, has there been a strictly Keynesian event. What I'm talking about, I'll go back to the basics and be real brief with it. The Keynesians feel that if you can fine-tune the economy, was the term, wasn't it, Carl?
Yeah.
It's something like that, where if you business cycles are always going to, there's always going to be a business cycle. You know, that's just the way the world is. It's the way people are. And they're not inherently dangerous, but they just are. And people overinvest in good times, and all of a sudden they overinvested, and there's a shakeout, and we go down and come back up again. So that's just a business cycle. But if the government was quick enough that when the economy was, quote, overheating, they would, like, raise taxes or cut back on their spending, they could take the top off the, essentially that sine wave. And then when they start to come down again, they could lower taxes or increase their spending and take the bottom off that sine wave. So you wouldn't stop it, but you could essentially nip the tops and nip the bottoms.
Yep.
But the problem is that there's nobody in government that's that quick to understand when it's happening.
Oh, no, Chief.
This is the classical argument. What happens is when people notice that the economy is overheating, and you sit there and go, okay, we're going to raise taxes or we're going to lower spending, by the time you pass the bill and it actually takes shape, it's a year from now, and you're probably going the other way. So,
Chief, the problem with the Keynesian idea is that the concept has validity. Unfortunately, if you take a look at the history of...
That's what I was just saying.
Yes. But it's not that people don't realize. It's that they refuse to do it.
Well, even so, if you pass the tax bill today, it would probably take effect January 1st of 27. You know, just the way...
But
I'm saying every time this happens, usually, not every single time, you could go back in history in other countries, the Fed becomes more... essentially joins the party and either increases the money supply or decreases it to kind of help, never really decreases it, to help the other guys out. So there's never really a purely Keynesian event. So
my point is simply that the withdrawal of the event never occurs. Okay.
Right, that's exactly right. And
at least in my adult life, it has never occurred.
Well, that's because, you know, the few phrases I remember from Milton Friedman that were spot on, and I don't know if they're in any book, they probably are somewhere, is that's why you can't let it get started, because it feels so good to some people you can't get it stopped.
Well, of course.
And until it gets to some horrible situation like in the 70s where people are gagging on 12 or 13% inflation year after year, maybe as much as 14. Because even then, the not everybody gets hurt. Some people do and some people don't. Some people have the ability to raise prices in some industries, maybe regulated industries, so like the cities yeah. and government. They just raise taxes. And Chicago here is in an absolute piss mode here because some people's property taxes are up 20%.
Well, welcome to the party, pal.
Yeah.
You voted for this set of policies, and now you're getting them good and hard.
Well, you know my opinion of the current mayor, but to pin this on his 18 months, that's not fair either. I mean, you go back to Mayor Daley, you know, selling parking meters and pulling the money into, and Mayor Daley was a friend of mine, and pulling it into current revenue. You know, same way with selling the Skyway and the garage and all the other stuff. All you did was shield a problem that's been coming for 30 years, as every industry's left the place.
Well, not only that, but you have a public school system that in many cases, I mean, which is a huge sink in any county.
Without a doubt.
Okay. And you know, nowhere is it a larger sink than in a city, because of population density. All right, I mean
it's 20% inefficient to 25.
Well, and you have, you know, situations where you're paying for an entire school building full of people, and there's, you know, 30 students in there.
Well, you're also supposed to be training people. You know, a lot of government, when you say government should act as a business. In some regard, the things you invest in as a government should come back in spades to you. I mean, when I look at my own situation, I'm never going to look in the mirror and say that I was not helped out by welfare, because I was. Most people are so friggin' arrogant, they don't realize that they have been helped out. Just because they have money, they've never been helped out by welfare. Yeah, you have. If your dad had a new hip put in when he was 68 and the bill was 80 grand and Medicare paid for it, I'll bet he never paid 80 grand to pay in the Medicare, and neither did you. And you didn't offer to pay. So, I mean, a lot of people, in fact, there's a book around, I think, died in my parents' flooded basement, welfare is not only for the rich. But now, in some cases, you know, the money that I got on dependent children, my dad died. My mom used my Notre Dame education, University of Chicago, because the education wasn't that much in those days. Well, I've paid them back spades in taxes. Right. So you could look at that as a huge investment. So if your city schools put out people that the next day they either go to college, or by the way, they're taught to be a welder or an electrician, and the next day they start paying taxes, you can get that money back right away if you do it right.
Oh, I'm not.
But they're not doing it right, is what you and I are saying.
Well, what I'm basically saying, is that the reality is that we have no accountability within that part of the system at all.
Plus, we don't have any of that kind of teaching anymore. We have a bunch of people that come out and they can't talk and they can't go to college. Part of that's family, or part of that's lack of family. We got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about in a half hour. What'd you think of the Home Depot stuff? Earnings are. I was in Home Depot Saturday, Carl. If I'd have said I had trouble in the can, somebody would have come and helped me. There were so many people. I had four people help me. Yeah, I didn't even ask for any help. There's nobody there in this area. There's none of the Hispanic guys outside looking for a job. There was normally on a Saturday you'll see five or six, a lot of the people that do that kind of work in Chicago. I'm talking regular contractors are Hispanic. I didn't see one guy hauling out plastic border stuff. Everybody's scared bleepless.
Everybody seems to think that this is, this is all because of, the immigration enforcement.
Ask those guys. It is. We've had people in the building here come up and use our color copier to make sure they have a copy of their passport with them at all times. They're just picking people up. Or now they're leaving, I guess, but they were picking people up.
Well, and certainly there's some of this, okay, that's part of it. But the other thing that goes along with it is if you take a look at the crunch that is hitting people from a standpoint of spending.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been commenting on this, all through the summer and into the fall. To be fair, I've only been here since 2020, right? So my perspective is somewhat skewed, but I have friends that have lived here for 20 plus years, okay? And the reality is that, if you've been here 20 years, you were here when the 08 kaboom boom happened, right? So you've seen the cycle on the bad side, and it's interesting because there's some of them who have tried to tell me that 08 there really wasn't much in the way of the feces hitting the air mover when it came to the foreclosures and stuff like that. And I go back and I take a look at the records and I go, oh, really? How come I can find like all these sales at 50% of what they sold for 2 years earlier, right?
Well,
by the way, that's all in a public database. Realtor.com keeps all that stuff, right? And it's like it is all there, and yet it's starting now in earnest, okay, with foreclosures. So now you're starting to see the foreclosure listings show up in the cabins.
Kind of started with cars. Now it's moving into houses.
Well, but that's the thing is that as you and I have commented before, one of the cures for high prices is high prices. Hello, there's all these people that were running around saying $10 a pound for ground beef is coming. Da 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 da. Gee, funny that someone seems to have bought a little bit too much of it because this last week I was able to get 3 pound packs at $3.99, which isn't a great price. That's 80-20, so it's the mid-grade stuff. It isn't a great price, but it's a hell of a lot better than $5.49, which is what it has been for the last 5 months, right? And funny, I don't think they sold very much at $5.49.
Well, no.
And so then all of a sudden it's like, hey, wait, if we don't get rid of this stuff, you can only keep it in the in the cold pack for a certain amount of time. If you're going to grind it.
Kind of makes you wonder when you go into one of these fast food joints and you're supposedly getting a quarter pounder and it's that cheap, you wonder what they're using.
Well, I have a pretty good idea what they're not. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Is it true that don't want to talk about before I say this, but there was a time there was only two burgers in all of fast fooddom that were 100% beef. I don't. There might be more now. Can you name them?
No.
White Castle and the Quarter Pounder.
Okay.
That was a while ago, so maybe there's more now.
I don't know that that's necessarily true anymore, yeah. So.
But for a while, I mean, the other ones just have a little filler. It's not like you... I mean, when a lot of people make burgers, they put little breadcrumbs in there. It holds them to get better.
Oh,
together,
yeah.
But it's not like it... But I just... You wonder, you know, the sentiment numbers are down.
Yeah.
When you talk about the housing numbers, you know, in 2007, I guess I could have been the big short, except I don't know how you shorted those things. I don't think anybody really could, because they were internal, a lot of them were internal, whatever you want, internal sales to other people.
Right.
But that was one of those things, to this day, Carol, I've argued about it with several of the guests. The problem clearly was that the housing prices were far out of reach of 85% of the wage earners.
Still are.
Well, now, I'm going to say it's worse now. But
yeah.
But we don't have at that time, and I wish if I had the time, I'd go back and review this whole stuff. Maybe you know it. I mean, there were $35 of leverage on every dollar mortgage.
Yeah.
And that should have been flagged by the Fed.
But it wasn't.
I mean, when I say that, people say, well, where the hell did that money come from? A lot of the money came from Japan.
Yeah. I mean, well, by the way, this is one of the things that's upsetting the apple since you mentioned Japan. I don't know if you've noticed, but all of a sudden, the longer term, you know, the how many people got carried out in their shield trying to short bonds over there, right?
We didn't get carried out in our shield, but that was the second biggest trade, the obvious trade of my lifetime. One was buying the market in 1981 and shorting the bonds when they were like at 130. And yet we did it, I'm going to say, 15 times, and maybe we made money 8. Every time it looked like it was for sure going to go down, the Fed would do something and jam it right up your behind.
Yeah, and well, but now you have, you know, and you have an awful lot.
Well, now it's gone from 120 to 80, so it was the right trade. Right.
Well, yeah. But I mean, the thing is that now the thing is that you have the end of the zero financing game over in Japan is you know, finally starting to show up and bite.
Yeah, they're 1.75. They were 0.01 for how long?
Uh-huh.
And guess what?
Yeah. Well, and guess what? That's where a lot of the leverage through the turn and burn carry trade stuff, all right, which still is out there under the surface.
A little bit.
You don't see it, but it's there. And the problem is that as that accelerates, this is the same thing that the Fed is going to face over here eventually, is that you can play with the short end, but at the long end, you know, and this is the biggest risk out there, I think, right now in terms of a dislocation type of event, is you can't run and hide in Japan anymore. Because no more zero rates there, right?
You don't have negative rates in Europe either.
No, and their movement and the you know, the slope is from the lower left to the upper right on rates over there, all right? Which is not going the right way if you're thinking you're gonna bet that direction.
Carl, should we have a little bit of a 5-question economics quiz before somebody's allowed to be on national TV? This constant,
well,
if the Fed lowers rates, everybody's mortgage rates are gonna go down. Fed lowered the rate twice. And the 10-year rate is up from then.
I was gonna say, gee, they've lowered rates, and the what you're paying did not go down.
No, and it's liable to go up if it causes more inflation.
Well, yeah, hello, and so you've got that problem, but then the other thing that you got going along with this is that you have this insane garbage going on in the tech sector, which is very 1998-ish or 1999-ish.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And by the way, that's all leverage financed, although people are trying to hide it. And when you start to see where the hiding is coming from, okay, like this crap that Facebook pulled with this data center that's got this off-balance sheet game that they're playing, I know where the answer is. The regulators are all in everybody's pocket. Nobody cares.
Well, they're around. They're coming after you or me.
Well, yeah, okay, but you know, and then you've got all this stuff that is abject fraud, in my opinion, having to do with depreciation schedules and how that's all being done, and that's being gamed as well.
That's a reporting issue. It's not a cash flow issue.
Well, it's a report. Yes and no.
Well, it could be a fraud issue if you're borrowing money to do it.
No. Here's the thing. And this is why I say it's a fraud issue, not just from a standpoint of borrowing. If you take the depreciation on something over 10 years, then the cost of that thing is spread over that period of time. Okay?
The cost in your financial accounting.
In my financial statements.
Doesn't right. necessarily match your tax statements. But go ahead.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, that in turn means, let's say that I have $100 billion that I spent, okay, and yet I'm going to recognize the loss of value of that over 10 years. So that's $10 billion a year. All right, fine. Assuming a straight line, which, you know, you can do it different ways, but assuming a straight line. So now, if I make $11 billion, doing this thing next year, then I can say I have a 10% positive ROI on what I had to buy, right? I made 11, and the cost spread out over the schedule is 10. That's a positive number, okay? It's black. All right, now here's the problem. If that thing only has a real economic service life of 2 years, after which I have to replace it because the guy down the street buys the new one, and if I don't, he takes all my business away because he's cheaper.
Okay. Well, yeah, but it's more of a real problem. I got to ask you this question. It's more of a real problem if the thing only works for you for three, and then you got a real issue.
No. But it does because
that's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying. And so now I made 11, but I spent 50.
Right.
Okay. And guess what? I get buried. And if I try to hide from that by not buying the new one, I get destroyed by the guy down the street who did.
Well, if anybody ever looked, and I'm guilty as this as anybody else, if anybody ever looked at the balance sheet or at the annual report or the quarterly report, you should be able to pick that up.
Well, I have.
Yeah.
All right. But here's the thing. I got 40 years of experience in this industry. All right. And I have never seen it not be that way in any kind of advancing area of technology in terms of service.
Well, it's even more horrific if you're borrowing money based on the
first. Oh yeah, well here's hey Chief, I had equipment that was 2 years old that I literally couldn't get a dollar for.
All right, hey, between now and we're down. If the crypto made it to $3 trillion, it's got to be down to $2.2 trillion.
Well,
is this you and I, I'm not going to take credit for this.
Digital tulips.
You picked up the blip in the one, was it a firm about 3-4 weeks ago? And everybody, wasn't there a hack in one of the exchanges or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you said, maybe this might just be the tip. Well, now it's 3 weeks later and all these things are down a bunch. Are they going to come back? Is this starting to spread? What's going on here? If this thing's going down another 20%, I think it hurts the market bad.
I think you've got, well, okay, there's no actual value in any of these things as a medium of exchange and a store of value because of the volatility, okay? The other thing that
because
happened
there is no value.
Well, duh. In fact, it's a cost sink because you
but
have
that
to
does,
spend
that doesn't mean if it's something's worth $3 trillion in the world and the next day it's one, there's not a problem.
Well, of course it's a problem. But here's the thing. On top of that, here's the other thing that showed up. It popped up in my feed yesterday. Apparently, there are an awful lot of people that have an awful lot of money that they've, they put in a little bit of money. Now, all of a sudden, they're very wealthy on paper with this crypto stuff. And they've been doing it on overseas exchanges and, of course, not paying any taxes. The whole reason they're doing it.
Well, because how much more you won't have to.
Well, okay. Well, anyway, the IRS is apparently getting rather interested in the people that have been committing tax evasion.
Well, it has to pop in the system somehow.
Well,
if you see Joel popping in, let me know. We'll let him in.
Yeah. I have a suspicion that there's a number of things, you know, but that's the way this kind of snowball tends to get going, right?
Well, how much of it is, this is a longer question, but it used to be, I'm talking 40 years ago, that the storehouse of value in Russia of wealth was U.S. $100 bills. You couldn't trust their own, and you didn't want anybody else's. Now, of course, we've depleted the value of the $100 bill dramatically over that 30 years. And I think some of those people have slid to the Bitcoin. And then I think they're going to get screwed again.
Well, yeah, and you know what? I have very little to zero empathy for anybody. I mean, as a guy who's...
Well, they tried ours. That didn't work.
Well, I've written lots of checks to the IRS over the years, okay?
Yeah.
Anybody that is playing games in a clearly bogus attempt to evade paying taxes by doing stuff overseas and, you know, this is with stuff like this. I mean, hey, you've got to declare a foreign bank account for crying out loud, and you've had to for quite a long period of time.
Simplify this for simpletons like me and maybe some of our listeners. Suppose I didn't, by the way. Suppose I was omniscient and ahead of everything. There's a term, omniscient, this hour in the morning.
There you go.
And I went to my Bitcoin ATM, you know, 20 years ago, like my brother did. Of course, he bought $20 worth, and they fleeced him for $4 on a fee, so he only got like $16 worth. But suppose I would have bought a Bitcoin and I actually pumped off my credit card $5,000 in there, which I never would have done. But suppose I did, and I'm sitting there, I'm holding the Bitcoin. All right, I got it. It's in there. How do I cash it? I can't go to the same ATM. What do I do with this thing?
Well, it has to be. I mean, you can transact with it privately, but nobody does in any kind of size.
I just want my money. I want my $100,000.
Yeah, well, you know, so you run it through Coinbase or whatever, and
so I have to go to those guys.
You can do it privately. It's like anything else. You can, but nobody does. All right,
but I have my password, and that's all I have right now.
Well, no, it has to be somewhere. So, I mean, you'd have to have it...
I have to have a wallet of some kind?
Yeah. I mean, it has to be held somewhere. So if it's going to be held, then, you know, presumably it's on an exchange. So Joel has popped in. So,
all right, well, let's go through this on Friday, because I wonder, I mean, how exactly do I get my $100,000 out, and where does it pop up? In my bank? How does the IRS find it? It has gone somewhere.
Oh, and believe me, everything is findable, because there is an indelible digital signature on every single transaction.
Well, another $100,000 in my bank account would be noticeable.
If they trace it, they will find it, because it is absolutely findable.
So there's no place I can go in the world where the guy just hands me $100,000 in Benjamins.
Well, there probably are, but the transaction's still recorded in the blockchain and it's traceable to you.
All right. Well, if it's traceable to me, how come somebody loses their password, they can't find it? Let's go through this on Friday.
You can't find the password, but the funds are still traceable, yeah.
So. Somebody's, Joel, how are you, buddy? Missed you.
Hey, good morning, Chief. Good morning. How's the crew doing today?
We're doing good. I was a little late getting on your thing last week, because you said
you're
you
fired.
You said
and I'm docking your pay, okay?
Well, I said, what are you having me back on? You say, we're scheduled out forever, but we'll get you back on. Next morning, I get an email. By the way, where are you? I'm like, whoops,
well,
that was
quick.
You know
what? I did a two-part email. And you didn't respond to both. But anyways, people don't want to hear this. You know what, Chief? I heard you and the boys talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I have two fundamental questions. Okay?
Go ahead.
The first, I guess a question.
You're assuming that I can answer them, but go ahead.
A question and a statement. The first statement is, one thing that I've always said about Bitcoin is the volatility is a transactional means of transactions. Like, let's say I owed you $100,000 that I was going to pay you in Bitcoin as of November 1st. Okay, but the due date on the money owed is maybe a couple weeks later. There's too much volatility in the intraday movement to make it a transactional currency.
Without a doubt.
Okay. Number two, you know, when we talk about, you know, stocks without
outrageous
valuation.
Well, the idea of a currency is supposed to be a storehouse of value. It's not.
Correct. Also, you know, when we talk about, like, valuations, you know, like, when's this stock's going to come to value? You know, when's it going to come down? You know, because you have the growth stocks, you have the momentum traders, they're buying. And the value people are like, no way am I touching this until it comes back down to a reasonable valuation. Then the momentum turns, and the momentum sellers are selling, but the value people are much lower. They're like, hey, I'm going to wait till this gets to a reasonable PE. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to be like Warren.
Yeah. Well,
and
I mean,
And where are they? Where is fair value in Bitcoin? Where are the earnings
there is
of
no,
Bitcoin?
There is no.
How can we establish a fair... What's fair value in Bitcoin?
Zero.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about zero. I don't know what
it is.
Well,
everybody says blockchain, but I don't own the blockchain. If I own the blockchain, I'd say it'd be pretty valuable.
I don't know, Chief. Those are going to be questions that are going to be answered when they write the book about this market, probably long after I'm gone. So, participating on the way up, participating on the way down, very difficult. I mean, now you have the public in it with all these ETFs. There's a lot of things. I think that one thing we didn't pay enough attention when the market was rallying to all-time highs, what Bitcoin was doing, because it's symbolic of the risk asset. I think this, if you had to blame two things for what's going on with the market, I think there are two things. I think, one, the Fed in December doesn't look like a slam dunk, another quarter point cut. We don't know what the economic data coming in. And I think a stock that's symbolic of the AI trade, Oracle, has just been in a gutter. It is now trading lower than it was when it announced all those potential revenues for 2030.
Well, so and they're also were involved for, in the what's the outfit with China are going to take? What's the Chinese organization that they either had to sell it or they were getting involved with the Trump deal. Not X. What's the other one? TikTok?
TikTok?
Yeah, they were gonna end up with TikTok too, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And that was all part of the mess. But what I mean, you what I'll put some numbers on it. It got to, I'm gonna say the tippy top was 325. Now it's 215.
It was higher than that, and it was actually if your investors want a little tip for like. Keep an eye, like euphoria days.
I got 328 was a high.
For Oracle?
Yeah.
That's the closing high, 328.33.
Okay. Yeah.
That day it hit 345.72.
Oh, okay. All right. Oops.
But, you know, one thing you keep an eye on with when stocks make those kind of moves is like that price action from that day. If you had been using the close from that day at 28.33, it only got up to that level one other time, 329.50, back on the 22nd, and it's never, you know, it's continued to struggle. Whereas AMD, you know, it had its moment in the sun, right?
Yep.
And it gapped up, and it went, and boom, it continued higher.
We're talking, when you start talking about $100 down like that, you're clearly, if you bought the top on margin, You've blown through the 30% maintenance, so you either have to sell it or you got to get a margin call if that's the stock you have. Because once you get below, when you buy something, if you bought 1,000 shares of Oracle at PTI or any place, you come up with half the money, right? But if it goes down, you don't have to feed the kitty right away. You don't have to feed it until it becomes 30%. There's a difference between initial margin and maintenance. But the moves Joel's talking about, you've blown through your maintenance, correct?
Yes.
And that's a problem. The other thing you brought up, though, the question: what do you do if you look at a Microsoft? And again, this is valuation stuff, and you know, maybe it's just two old guys talking. But I've got Microsoft, and I calculated it yesterday, Joel, and I think it's like 12.5. Well, it's down $6 today, so it's not the same. It was 12.5 times revenue. I've never seen a stock that mature, that big, trading 12.5 times revenue. Ever. Now, if I say that's too high, now the stock's down $6 this morning, it's trading 501. We're going to get 15 swinging idiots on TV saying it's a bargain here, buy the dip. You and I are sitting there going probably, I'm not going to touch this thing till it's 8 times revenue, or maybe 7.5. We're not even close. But now, is there enough growth? Is there enough? If we are talking 7 to 10 stocks are going to rule the world? And we're going to keep pouring money in the system. Maybe it's not too cheap, but these are variables, Joel. You and I—we never had these kind of variables 20 years ago. I mean, these are the very. Are we going to let them take over other places? Are we going to let the money go in? Is the dollar going to be worth this much less 4 years from now? So Microsoft will be trading 1,000. I mean, we better stay in. We never had to think like that. Now we do, don't we?
It's a learning experience every day in this market, Chief, and you and I know that. And other factors have come in. You know, the markets are not ruled by market maker. You know, they're ruled by computers and machines, and they don't care. They don't care about this stuff. They don't care about valuations. They get a move like that in Oracle, and they take it. They take it. Now, I tell you, I'm a hell of a lot more interested in adding Oracle to my long-term portfolio at 216 than I am at 300. So right now, it's not finding any kind of a base. I just, you know, agree or disagree with me. They talk about the debt. They talk about what's going on. If you're looking for this market to stabilize, turn up, go new all-time highs by the end of the year, you need to catch a bid in Oracle. You need, or at least for it to stop going down at the rate that it's going down. So,
big question. We don't have that much time.
Oh, yep.
First of all, by the way, I really enjoyed being on your show. Those guys are terrific.
I'm glad you got on with somebody else. I mean, I think that's the key.
Whatever. I hope I don't start talking about stuff that happened 30 years ago. But your guys are great. The questions are terrific. I mean, I got to believe the market doing this during the day. You got all kinds of people listening. You have to.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, but I got a hot check out.
Hey,
whoa,
you got to give me 30 seconds.
What, 30 seconds.
How nervous are you about this VIX at 23.5? I'm sitting there going, this is way too high. Something's going on someplace that we don't know about. I've never seen it that high. And just like,
I mean, I know you're an option guy. I follow options. I have my internal VIX. And that's the S&P 500 futures, and ain't a lot of support in here. Ain't a lot of support. So if all your investors, all your listeners, go look at your monthly charts, and you see a big red candle, the first red candle we've had in 6 months. Tell me where there's support. Tell me where you would back up the truck. Now, I'm not saying we're going to 6,600 or 6,500 or 6,000, but there has to be stability. There has to be support. There can't be ridiculous 120-point rallies like on Friday. There's got to be stability. There's got to be a little bit of a base. Or you do your V-bottom like you did in April. But right now, I mean, I don't care what the bulls are saying. Right now, the technicals are not bullish. If you're just using the 50-day moving average, we're trading below it in the S&P. We are well below. We are struggling with it in the triple Qs. And the IWM is well below it. So get back to the 50-day. If you can't get back up to 50-day, pull up your 200-day. And that's very well where we may be going.
We're going there. That's not good.
Go blue.
All right, buddy. Do we have Kenny?
We do.
Hey, bud. All week, everybody's been talking about you and your friend Talia. What an amazing show that was. And we just ended it up yesterday with Diane was on again talking about the stuff they're trying to do in the place.
Diane missed it. Didn't Diane not make it last week? Right?
It was better this way, actually, because then she kind of started it and ended it. Because it's kind of two separate things. She's doing stuff in the home, and you guys are doing, when I say the veterans home, and they're having issues up at the new one at Lovell, because a lot of the psychological issues they're dealing with there are people that are on active duty. That's the only veterans hospital that is designed for both veterans and people that are active duty. So they're coming. So there's actually like a whole bunch of levels of this, and you guys is separate enough to where it probably worked out better the way it did. Just saying, but
all right. Well, that's good. Listen, she was Talia was thrilled to have had the opportunity to be on. She enjoyed the conversation with Hal as well. Hal, thank you very much for jumping in there and participating. I'm sorry I had to jump off, but I didn't get to it. But she enjoyed the whole thing.
There was no room for either one of us, Kenny. They took it. They took over. Hey, you know, it's even more another little wrinkle, and Hal brought it up. Is what happens when you're out, and then like Wayne. Wayne was talking on Thursday because he listened to him, and Wayne was in the Navy years ago. And I said, "Well, what happened when you got booted out?" He goes, "They asked me what's your home address." He goes, "They're not there anymore. I don't know what my home address is." And it's one of the guys who used to work with us, a good friend forever. I said, "JD, when did you when you get?" He was a Vietnam era guy that went to Europe for 2 years, because our deal was our year, if you got caught in the lottery, you couldn't, there was no school deferment, but you didn't go to Vietnam. So he was in Germany driving a truck for 2 years. And I said, when they let you out, where they let you out? He goes, I don't know, Fort Dix. Did they give you a plane ticket? He goes, I don't even remember. I don't think so. I said,
probably not.
But he, at least his family was still together and had a place, and his room was still there. He could go pile into it. But I mean, none of these guys, there's no such thing about here's how you get your own employment, here's how you get an apartment. How do you get an apartment without a job?
Well, that's right. How do you? And that's part of the, you know, that's clearly part of what we're trying to fix and change. Yeah.
But you guys, we collectively have opened up probably 8 different issues.
Yeah.
In a week. I mean, do we even check anybody out when they leave? Mike Murphy said, if you're an officer, they give you a full physical.
Yeah.
And match it up with your physical when you went in, to try and see if you deserve any, you know, what do you want to call it, medical benefits. Or not, or something you can complain later. They try and match the two up, but it doesn't sound like any of the worker bees get anything like that.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think so.
But anyway, you know, kudos to you guys.
Thank you very much for that opportunity. I know I appreciate it. I know she did as well, and she enjoyed the conversation, and so it was good.
By the way, Ricky's going to send you the thing, and he's going to email you he cut it all up and stuff.
Okay, great, perfect.
All right, so what about this market? What about this VIX?
So listen, the VIX, you know, when I got here this morning, the VIX was not up that much. It has since surged in the last hour, which is very interesting. But I'm not necessarily surprised. Look what happened in Asia. Japan was down 3%. South Korea was down 3%. Taiwan was down 2.5%. European markets are all lower, down 1.5%. So I'm not necessarily surprised. I certainly expect that that's what's going to happen here today as well. Look, there's a shakeout coming. Now, on top of all the other concerns that they're talking about, stretch valuations and the Fed and the NFP report and all that, now they're talking about the fact that Amazon, you know, had a $15 billion bond auction yesterday. They raised $15 billion in a bond offering. There was $80 billion worth of demand, by the way. What was supposed to be a $12 billion offering, they upped it to $15 just because there was so much demand. And now that's on top of Meta and Oracle and Google all raised money in the bond market. And so now the argument on top of everything else is, well, what are they doing? They're not using free cash now to fund their expansion. Now they're using debt, and that's not sustainable, and blah, 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 and it's going to be pets.com all over, which makes me laugh, because how can you compare a sock puppet to NVIDIA or Palantir or Amazon or Microsoft or IBM? You cannot. It's ridiculous. So,
don't include Palantir in that group.
Although Palantir is not a sock puppet, but whatever, we can talk about that. But one way or the other, look, I don't think this is anything other than that correction that, you know, we talked about. I thought it was coming in September, October. It never came. They pushed stocks higher. And so ultimately, there has to be a correction. You and I both know that. The fact is, this one's going to feel uncomfortable because they push us to even higher highs than we were at. And so, you know, when the pullback happens, it's going to feel a little bit more uncomfortable. But look, the indexes are still well within normal trading. Now, individual names are not. Amazon's already down 12%, and Palantir's down 18%. And, you know, they're all down double digits. I get it. But the indexes themselves are still in that normal trading range. But I fully suspect, especially now with the VIX ramping up now in the last hour, that we're going to get more pressure. In fact, the Dow futures went from, you know, down 160 to down 300 when that happened. As did the S&P and the NASDAQ and everything else. So I fully expect there's going to be this kind of flush, which, by the way, should be okay. I've been waiting for this. So as far as I'm concerned, this is an opportunity for some of my clients that have been sitting there in cash and waiting, because I've been saying, listen, wait. Meanwhile, the market was moving higher. They kept saying, Kenny, when's it coming? It's coming. Well, hopefully this is it. So we'll see.
Well, some of the thing that I was talking about with Joel a little bit, and you and I, it wasn't last week because we had the veteran stuff last week. The week before that, we were talking about the margin debt. Because I was talking about with you and Hal. And
margin debt, leverage, yep.
I just noticed that I try and watch this stuff all day long like you, but I zero in more on the Qs, and we do more of a protected index stuff than we do other stuff. But the I looked, Joel forced me, goaded me into looking at the Oracle this morning. If you'd have bought so many stocks that you're rattling off, if you'd have bought them on margin on the top, you're getting margin calls now.
100%.
Yeah, you're way through your maintenance. Yeah, I had not noticed.
100%.
Why I had not noticed that? So thank you.
If you're using margin at the top, you're getting your head handed to you. You know, listen, I just noticed something. I noticed that the VIX shot higher when an announcement came out that ChatGPT and X are down because there's a Cloudflare problem affecting ChatGPT and Twitter. And that's interesting because when that announcement came out is when the VIX shot higher.
Do you think, and why am I always suspicious about this, Kenny, is there fire where there's smoke in this? In the crypto world, I got them down about $700 billion in value.
Yeah,
on the top.
Yeah. You know, we could be going into another crypto winter, which some people, you know, the crypto experts say no. But others are starting to wonder, you know, could this be another one of those cycles where we see Bitcoin really get smashed, or not? I'm not sure. For one, I would love to see it get smashed so I get a chance to put more to work, right? I was tired of paying $100,000 for bits of Bitcoin as I've been buying it. So I'm much happier to buy it at $50,000 than $100,000.
Would you say, what is the, I don't know, we were ranting and raving the other day regarding individual stocks. And, I said if you go back to the basics on this, no matter when you buy a stock, you know, you could buy a railroad the first day the spike goes in and you're anticipating whatever your future is. We can have all kinds of estimates of how much money the place is going to make and when, and that's what makes a market. That's the beauty of what we do, Kenny. I mean, that's the fun of it. But at the end of the day, I think everybody, and this is lost on momentum traders, at the end of the day, someday, somewhere, and we can wrestle and arm wrestle about whether it's going to be 2027, 2032, someday, somewhere, this $100 stock better be making $10 a year and sending you a check for four. I think people don't believe that. When is that ever going to happen to Bitcoin?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen in Bitcoin. Bitcoin's going to be like gold, right? It doesn't pay you a dividend. It doesn't earn interest. Doesn't do any of that stuff, right?
Yeah, except I can look at my gold.
Yeah, listen, I hear you. I can look at my gold. I can hold my gold. I can put my gold in my backyard, bury it in my backyard.
Or you can put some in a tooth if you need it, you know?
I don't think they do that anymore.
I've only got one crown. It's a gold one. It's been from years ago.
But you and I are boomers, right?
Yeah.
I don't think if you're 20 years old, they're putting gold in your mouth now. They're using all this synthetic stuff now.
Yeah, you know what the game is. You know what the game is there. All these guys have these machines where they make the crown for you.
Yeah.
And the machine costs a bunch of dough. And the reason why they're so expensive is you got to use the stamp from the guy that made the machine.
They got to do what?
The whatever you want to call it, the thing they start with, whatever it is, the piece of plastic that's being dumped.
Yeah.
They have to use the one from the place. They charge a fortune for those things, even though they don't cost that much. It's beautiful, isn't it? The world we're in.
Well, listen, it's the way it is, right?
If you had to list your biggest dangers, my biggest ones, I went through Microsoft yesterday, and I had it at about a 12.5 revenue. 12.5 times revenue per share, and I'm like, wait a minute, that's awful high for a company that now it could be that they have a bunch of stuff going for them and everything else, but my problem is I can't put 10 of them like that and justify all 10. Why talk me out of this, will you? Because why do I have this real fear? I can't put any kind of a liking on this guy who runs NVIDIA. He looks to me like...
Why can't you? I think he's a great guy.
He reminds me of the Harold Janine of our generation. He doesn't care if he makes money in China or here or any other place.
Because he's got... I hear you, but he's got so much of it, so what's he care?
But they do care. They do care.
Yeah.
The richest people I know are the guys that are going to shave on a tip in a bar. That's why they got the dough, Kenny, because they don't spend it. Isn't that the truth? I mean, when was the last time you saw an overly generous rich guy? Not that they are not out there, but I don't see too many of them. Until they're ready to croak, then they want to give it away to a foundation, and then they're going to buy indulgences.
Give it away to a charity.
Does anybody buy indulgences anymore? Where all these guys give this like $50 million to Notre Dame after they've been stealing it their whole life, I go, okay, what, you just buy your way into heaven here? What is it? I thought we stopped doing that in the Middle Ages. I, you know, maybe we did. What, so what, who's the, well, you guys raised the money. I'm slipping back to the, who manages the organization, and who decides when to go to another state, and how do you recruit the?
Well, so you know, there's a CEO, the executive director, and all that. Then there's a board, of which I sit on the board, right, to oversee it. But then we really decide on where to go based on need, right? So the clinicians and everything are very much a part of that. The head clinician is very much a part of that, identifying where the needs are, where we're seeing a lot of, you know, maybe calls coming in, or maybe, you know, it's a state that has a lot of veterans that, you know, there's not enough support. So, you know, there's a process that they go through to identify kind of how we grow. And also, listen, it also is going to depend on where we get support, right? You need to get organic support kind of in the places you're going to, right? It's tough to go to New York and say, you know, we want you to support, you know, veterans in Idaho. Well, to go to Idaho and let them support the veterans, which is, you know, that, some of that is true, some of that isn't, but you need to be able to gather some organic support to where you're going. So we're already, like I said, we're in 19 states already physically, meaning, you know, with real clinicians, not with buildings, right, with just our clinicians. The other states we do telehealth, but then I think they're, what did Talia say last week? I think there's five or six more states that are, you know, have been identified to grow into over the next year and a half.
Well, are there pockets? I remember reading, I saw this once, Kenny, and of course I lose the stuff that's so valuable. It had to do with somebody actually went through and talked about the states that get the most money from the federal government.
Yeah.
And the dude, I think it was actually a guy and a lady wrote the article. They wrote it, and it was about, they took three things. They took the amount of, you know, like bases and those kinds of things, but also the amount of people in the state that are getting a government pension, and there was like three different things. And is there a concentration, like Wayne said, he was tossed out in New York, I think, because he was in the Navy, and my buddy JD got tossed out at Fort Dix, and Hal got tossed out the naval base in like Seattle or whatever, Bremerton, wherever it is. Is there a concentration of vets in those areas because they have nowhere else to go and they'll just look for a job right away when they get tossed, or do they all kind of go home if there is a home? Or are there states, I guess, if you had to just look at a map and look at some numbers, could you and Talia say, okay, we got to start in these eight states because look how many people are there? Is it because there's bases there? Or is it because what causes that?
It started originally because of the bases. That's where the bases were located, is how we started. But then, you know, you start to expand. Bases aren't located everywhere, but then you start to expand in places where, you know, their veterans seem to congregate, or veterans seem to, you know, not congregate, but where they live, right? And so that's how you then identify kind of the next places to go. But originally, the states that we first started are naturally where all the bases are. And so from there, then we moved on. But look, the program, you know, helps these guys come get their life back, and then helps them, you know, find their way, whether it's through, while we don't provide jobs for them, we've got lots of connections and connections across all industries where other veterans are, where there's support, where there's an opportunity for these veterans to, you know, come back into the real world. So while we don't do that specifically, we can certainly help them.
Kenny, if you had to put a percentage on it, I mean, Talia was saying when she went for help to the vet, you know, basically it was, you know, she didn't say November, but they gave her like an appointment in April, and yet you guys get back to somebody in a couple of days. How much of it is just the care is there quickly versus, it's got to be 80% of the game must be that, isn't it?
Well, it is, but listen, the VA, let's be honest, the VA is overwhelmed.
Oh, sure.
Overwhelmed, and they're a government agency, and so, you know, they don't have the funding, they don't have the people, they don't have the ability to deal with it, right? So we you know, when these men and women call us, right, we typically have a turnaround time probably 24 hours when somebody contacts you back after you submit an inquiry, you know, that it's within 24 hours that you'll get the first call from the intake coordinator, who will then, you know, ask you a bunch of questions to get you qualified for the type of trauma that you've suffered, and where you live, and who the right doctor might be, because they'll do all that stuff. But that's the benefit of, you know, the organization that we have, is we've got the ability to do that. We've got, you know, we're at the moment we're serving about 2,000 veterans. I will say, but 2,000 veterans across the country, right? But ever since they started cutting funds out of D.C., we've seen an uptick, naturally, because the VA's been getting, the VA lost some funding, and so now they can't handle it, and so they actually send them to us. But the problem now with us is we're not funded by anybody, right? We're funded only through donation and through raising money and grants and all that stuff. So the push is on for us to have to go out and raise more money in order to serve more veterans, which we're happy to do, but raising money is now the issue, well, which is why, you know, it's about the exposure, right?
If I was going to go down this road, I don't think you would disagree with me that if, and again, I wish I could find the piece of paper, I'll zero in on the Iraq thing. When the neocons, Bush and his gang, decided to invade, I think most of them so they could get some oil, but they decided to invade, there was a dude that wrote an article about how he was talking about casualties and talking about how many of them, this is physically now, how many probably would be missing legs and missing stuff, because that's, we patch people up now. We don't just let them die, which is a good thing, I guess. And he was saying that he estimated that thing as $1.5 trillion. And the administration was talking, you know, how many billion, and it's going to take us, you know, 8 months to knock these guys out. Well, it took us a hell of a lot longer than that. But at the same time, roughly the same time, they put through a tax decrease. Now, if you would have said, okay, this war is going to cost us $1.5 trillion, we're going to give everybody a 20 or 25% tax surcharge for the next 3 years, and we're going to put all that money in a pot so that now when you're talking 15 years later and all these people have physical and some mental problems, the money's going to be there. I don't think we would have gone to war, Kenny, because nobody would have wanted their... If you would have been straight with people, why are they floundering around for money? People knew how much it was going to cost at the time. And as much as I love what you're doing and Diane's doing, and by the way, I'd like to help, we shouldn't be doing that. They should have the dough.
Agreed. They yeah. should. Yeah. Agreed. They should, but they don't.
But they don't. So
they just don't have enough yeah. of it, right?
And to a certain extent, I don't want to encourage him to do it again, I guess is my... How do I even say that? In other words, next time they do it, I want somebody to say, this is what it's going to cost. And if we're going to go invade... I hope we're not going to invade Venezuela. But if we do, we're going to end up with 10,000 casualties, which I sure as hell hope we don't. We better find a way to take care of these people. And by the way, this is what it's going to cost. And we're not going to lower taxes. We're going to raise taxes, and we're going to put it in a pot. That's just me. I guess because I'm a cost accountant. But we don't do that. And then all of a sudden, we're always surprised. Hey, wait a minute. These people are sick. Well, duh.
Sorry
for my rant. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's right. But they are. But and I support everything you say. But the fact is, it is what it is, which is why we try and work hard to try to assist as best we can.
Yeah, they should be sending you a check, saying you're doing our work for us here.
Well,
yeah, that's not going to happen.
I hear you. Yeah. It's not going to happen. But all we can do is kind of get the word out, let people understand who we are, what we're doing, how we're helping, and hope that, you know, generous people out there, or foundations or big corporations, right, that may have a philanthropic arm, would reach out and help support this effort. That's really right. That's really what we're hoping.
Hey, you know what Dye's doing? What's an interesting idea, maybe you guys for next year. They're having a fundraiser at a Legion Hall. Now in New York, you guys can get a nice hotel or something. They're having a big fundraiser at the Army-Navy game. People coming to the afternoon watching the game and ponying up money. That's kind of neat.
Oh, perfect. That's actually, you know, I should suggest that.
I was going to say, if she said feel free and steal the idea, go ahead, she likes you.
What a great idea.
Yeah. Have 100 people show up at a nice hotel place, a nice big screen and $1,000 a plate, and we'll watch the game.
Yeah. Wow, what a great idea. Okay.
See?
I'm going to submit that. Thank you very much.
All right, take care, buddy. Have a nice week. Trade them well. We have Professor Hal.
Yes, we do.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
What do you make all this? You've been listening all week, and your name has been bandied about. And I was talking to one of my buddies who you said they kind of dumped you off in the water in Bremerton, and he said, yeah, they dropped me off at Fort Dix. Okay. And Wayne said they asked him, well, what's the address when you mustered in? And he goes, nobody lives there anymore. What are we gonna do? Knock on the door?
Well, you know, the funny thing about me is I'm an economist, and before I even took any economics classes,
I was economizing, like when I was a kid, and instead of just mowing the yard, because it was my job for about 3 years to mow the yard, and we had about, I don't know, a football field of grass, I found the shortest path to getting the grass done as quickly as possible when I was 10. And so when I got out of the Navy, I'm being processed, and they said, hey, what state do you want to be discharged into? And I go, well, I'm going to college in the fall, and I'm going back to college in the fall.
What if you said a state of marijuana or something?
Well, then you end up in Seattle.
Okay, there you go.
But I just said, I'm going to college in the fall, and I wasn't really planning on going to work after the service. So I was talking to the guy, and he goes,
so you already signed up for a GI Bill?
I was getting the GI Bill, yeah, but I was kind of, you know, indifferent about what state I went to. And the guy told me, look, what you want to do is, you're going to go to college in a couple months, you're going to be on unemployment until you go to college. What I'd do is I would discharge into a state that has really generous unemployment benefits. And I go, well, what would that be? And he goes, well, you're from Idaho, but you're in Washington right now. If you say Washington, then your unemployment benefits are going to be higher. And then in a couple months, when you go to college, you can just roll right into college. So I said, all right.
Do they pay you while you're in college, or do the unemployment benefits work while you're in college?
Well, this is the interesting thing is, I told them, well, I'll discharge into Clarkston, Washington, because it's right across the river from my parents' house in Lewiston, Idaho. They're basically the same community with a river, which is the border, splitting the two, right? So I discharged into Washington, and I think my brother Ryan was living in Washington at the time, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go to Washington State or Lewis Clark State College. And so I discharged into Washington, and as soon as I showed up to the welfare, or not the welfare, the unemployment office in Washington State the day after I discharged, or whatever it was, it might have been a time period of a week or something, I don't know.
Did you have leave money? Wayne said he had like 6 months of leave money.
Not really, because I'd used it all.
Okay.
We were underway all the time, so anytime I could, I used it. So I had no leave money left.
Okay, because he was in court or something. I don't know what he was doing, but he said he had like 6 months of leave time.
Yeah. I didn't have any leave time because we were underway all the time, and anytime I got time off, like when we were in a foreign port and I didn't get liberty, I would take leave. So I wouldn't have to do duty during the port visit. When we were in San Diego, I used my leave to have Thanksgiving weekend off because we were in port for like a month and a half. So I was always using my leave because we were always underway. And that was the case for a lot of people.
Well,
if
you got booted today, could you make the January semester, or could you get into a place that quick, or was it, how long did it take?
Well, I think at the time my brothers and I were all, well, except for my brother Ryan, he was married. He was in Clarkston, Washington. My other two brothers and I were living together in an apartment in Edmonds, Washington. And then I'd ride the ferry across the bay to a ferry terminal just north of Bremerton. And that's how I got to work every day. And that wasn't every day because my apartment was in Edmonds, but I would stay on the ship if I had the work week. But on the weekend, I'd go back to the apartment where my brothers were. So I got discharged into Edmonds, Washington. And I could have gotten discharged into Idaho, but I got discharged into Edmonds, Washington. And my brothers knew that I was going to move back to Lewiston to go to college. So I was out of the apartment when school started. And when I went to the unemployment office, the guy goes, hey, we got a program for veterans. It's called JTPA. And I go, well, what is it? And he goes, well, if you go to college and you get a vocational degree, like in auto mechanics, for example, we'll continue to pay your unemployment benefits, we'll buy your tools, and we'll pay your tuition. I go, wow. Sign me up. So the first year I go back to college, this is the second time I go back to college. The first time I dropped out to join the Navy. So I go back to college the second time. I enroll in Lewis Clark State College's vocational automotive program. They bought me a complete set of tools. They paid my tuition. And at Lewis Clark State College, I could take as many credits as I wanted in the automotive program, and I could take credits in the academic program.
Wow.
At the same time. So I did both. I was full-time automotive, and I was full-time business, and my teacher in the automotive program was just impressed by that.
Kevin was saying,
and then I took this test, and I continued to collect my unemployment benefits that entire year. So I'm probably the only PhD economist that has a 1-year automotive.
Well, can you get a? I mean, in Chicago now, the rents are getting so bizarre. If they don't want you, I mean, they want like if the rent's $2,000, they want you making $6,000 that month. Who rented you a place with just unemployment?
Well, I was staying with my mom, I think.
Okay.
At that point, yeah, I was staying with my mom. And Lewiston, the rents were cheap back then.
Okay, yeah.
Plus, I was getting my GI Bill. So I was getting $400 a month.
Now, this is back when you went to class.
The 90s. This is back in the 90s.
Because Kevin was saying last week at Ivy that the veterans group is really strict on how many of these classes, if they're paying, you can take Zoom.
Yeah. Back in the 90s, they just gave you a check each month.
Okay, because he's saying that you got
to... And all you had to do is have the minimum number, and I had more than the minimum. I mean,
we'll ask him tomorrow, but I think he said if you're taking four classes, like, only one of them can be Zoom or something.
This is before Zoom.
Yeah, I'm saying before. But now, you can't just say I'm going to school and never show up.
I went to school.
Yeah.
I was doing the automotive program in the first 4 hours of the day. Then I was taking my business school class.
Were you brakes, engine? What were you? What were you? Brakes, engine, alignment? What were you?
I did all of it. I've rebuilt engines, transmissions, differentials. I've done body work in that program. I mean, I did electrical.
What'd you do that for, to become an economics professor?
Well, I had no idea what economics was at that point. I mean, I was born an economist and I was born a statistician, but I was a business major.
An economist. You were like 6 months old and you're an economist?
Oh, yeah. I was born to be an economist, yeah. But I had no idea what a PhD was at the time. I was just... My plan
PhD,
was...
PhD, Papa has dough.
My plan was to finish my business degree and then parlay that with my 1-year automotive certificate into being a service manager at, like, Sears Automotive.
You ever heard that expression? Like that. What's that girl doing with that dopey guy? Papa has dough.
I was like, FUD? What's FUD? I don't know what FUD is.
So
I know how to fix cars.
All right,
we're gonna
shift gears a little bit because that thing you sent yesterday.
The email. I was like, poof.
Well, first of all, I can barely read it because your whatever script you're using was so small, and I've got old eyes. All right, Kevin says, not Zoom, the asynchronous, whatever. He can talk about it on Wednesday. Online classes, you can't do all online classes. Well, he can explain the difference.
Then it was just a one lump sum payment each month. And as long as you had like 12 credit hours, you got your full check.
Well,
and I was taking 24 at the time, I think.
So Hal sent me this thing that A, to test my eyesight, and B, and B for me. And
now,
you know,
there is such a thing called Zoom, you know.
I don't know how to do that stuff.
Not Zoom as in we're on Zoom right now, but as in you can Zoom in on it.
I need an assistant for that. I mean, I don't have one. From time to time, I've ranted kind of foolishly, but not all the way through the subject on the changes in banking since I learned all about banking, which has been a while. And I keep talking about stuff like reserve requirements, knowing that there really aren't any now. And then
there's not.
And I talked about our friend Robert, who's he just retired. He was a big shot at the Fed, not a governor, not the guy you see on TV giving speeches, but in behind the scenes movement of money. And a lot of this happened, I think, you know, with Dodd-Frank and before some of the holding company act. This has been kind of a let's start at the beginning. If you let's go back to Bonanza, if anyone remembers the show. If Hal drops $1,000 in the Virginia City Bank, banks used to have what was called a reserve requirement. If the reserve requirement, which was for years and years, was like 21% or 20.5%, right? You know? So
it was about 20, yeah.
It was a give or take 20.5%, 21%. And any kind of movement, if the Fed changed the reserve requirement, was buku problems, not problems, but it was a huge change in the market. That was like the death blow or whatever, if the Fed had to do that. So bottom line, let's say it's 20%. Hal dumps $1,000 in the bank. I come in looking for a loan. They say we can lend you $800 because our reserve requirement, and we got to keep a reserve of 20. So they'll lend me. Chief gets $800. Now I put that $800 back in the bank. Now the money supply has just gone up for 800, right? Because now the bank, there's 1,000 that Hal has and 800 I have. They're all money. Okay, so now, so then Ricky comes in and says, hey, I need a loan. Okay, well, now they can only lend him 640, right? But now the 640 goes in the bank, and money supply grows. But it was a way to keep some sort of herd. You couldn't just, you know, Hal brings in 1,000, they lend 1,000. It was some idea, you know, it was a risk control, it was something, it was a way to keep some kind of control on the money supply. And that number kind of went up and down, up and down. And all of a sudden they decided they're not going to do that anymore. Just kind of give me my history of this, Hal, and then you tell me where I'm wrong. They decided to use bank net capital stuff, which to me has nothing to do, is a totally screwed up way of doing this. Maybe because I just like the old system. So it got to the point where, you know, how does this have to do with the Fed? Well, it got to the point where if you deposited money at a bank, if it was considered fast money or something like that, the bank had actually have more capital than they had the day before. So it got to the point where you're like, wait a minute, you're a bank, I can't give you money and you won't give out a loan. What exactly good are you? But so the Board of Trade Clearing and other clearing corps, OCC and DTC, does stock in the options, they could have $400 million one day in excess, or 500, and then a week later have it to go the other way. So it got to the point where if the exchanges went to J.P. Morgan and said, okay, we got to deposit $500 million overnight, they would say no, because they needed more than that capital, because your $500 that you just gave them might leave tomorrow. And they're going to go, they know that. They could just keep it there. They don't have to lend out on it. But no, they couldn't do that. So now we got this kind of bizarre world where the money in the bank is not having to do with the loans. It has to do with the deposits versus net capital, which I don't know where the hell they got on that, Hal, at all. And so the whole
makes
system...
makes no sense to
so,
me at all.
So what ended up... So Robert's solution, which was brilliant, it shouldn't have to happen. Now the exchanges have a direct portal to the Fed, where if they get an extra $500 million, instead of going through J.P. Morgan, where they don't want the money, bank doesn't want money again. What kind of oracle do we have here? They could go right to the Fed and deposit the money at the Fed, which I guess is a solution to what never should have been a problem in the first place. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, the way they got it set up is really perverse. I didn't really understand how perverse it was, but we were kind of touching on it.
That's what I'm saying. We've been touching around, and then you sent that thing yesterday, and they're on one page is exactly what we've been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't really understand it.
Yeah.
Until I was preparing for this class today, and I'm like, wait a minute, this has a really perverse incentive.
It's bleeped up.
Right? Yeah, if you lend to just billionaires and these blue chip corporations.
Well, that I didn't know about. So go through that slow. That I didn't know about. I read that twice. So go through that slow.
Yeah. Your risk profile, if you can get your loan set up in a way where your risk profile is really low, which means you're lending to just billionaires and blue chip corporations, then you have a low risk weight, and you don't have to have very much equity at all in the bank. You don't have to have much at all. Your capital requirements are really, really low. And in that situation, with there's no reserve requirement, it means you are probably gonna have, so now it's not really a reserve requirement ratio as it was in the past, where it was 20%, then they lowered it 10%.
In those days, the 20%, right? Let me fill in here. In those days, the 20% was for everybody. It didn't matter who the guy was. You had to retain 20%. And now, go ahead, Al.
Now it's not really about the reserve requirement ratio because it's set at zero. Now it's the desired reserve ratio of a specific bank. So if a bank owner kind of feels like there's a lot of people pulling money out, then they're going to have a higher desired reserve ratio.
Well, you would hope.
You might have it set at 40.
You would hope. People are pulling money out, duh.
But another bank where they haven't seen a lot of outflows, they might think 5% is okay. So now it's kind of like the bank sets their own reserve requirement.
Which is
insane.
They kind
of do it based
on
history. And if they have all their loans made to risky borrowers, like small startups that, you know, are the guys are rolling the dice, or a bunch of small businesses, their desired reserve ratio for themselves is going to be probably maybe a little higher. But if you compare that to a bank that only lends to big blue chip corporations and billionaires, then their desired reserve ratio is going to be a lot smaller. And so you can get into a situation where a bank has this perverse incentive to only make loans to people who have spot-on credit, billionaires.
Nobody wants to work their fanny off to give
loans.
And
then in that situation, the money multiplier could be not just 10, it could be 100.
Yeah.
It could be 1,000.
Could be infinite, almost.
Yeah, $100 million injection by the Fed can be multiplied into a million. It can be multiplied into $1 billion new dollars. Well, because there's no restraint.
Well, not to mention, if you're going to give out, I actually went to Lakeside a couple years ago, just this is a question, because I know the lady there forever, our banker. Her name's Fanny. She's terrific. I go, Fanny, you guys even do car loans? She goes, if you want one, we'll give you one tomorrow. But do we do them? No.
No, they don't.
They don't. Yeah. I mean, so the idea of, plus there's work.
They're risky loans.
If you're going to hire somebody really bright, you know, like Jimmy used to, the guy who helps us out on Monday and Thursday, you're not going to hire Jimmy to work his fanny off to get loans to 15 different plumbing and home repair companies that have terrific track records. A, you got to pay him, right, to do all his work. B, you got all his processing to do. And C, they're considered crummy loans, and you don't want them in the first place, even though they have always paid. It's perverse, isn't it, Hal? And why?
Well, there's a lot of labor involved. In that, whereas you only need one guy making loans to a big corporation or a billionaire. You only need a couple guys to do that, so you can lower your cost. And I mean, for example, on a $10 million loan to a billionaire, that might require only like $90,000 in regulatory capital. But $10 million spread across these small businesses that we're talking about, that may require $450,000 in regulatory
capital. Not to mention, it's one guy going to lunch with the guy and drinking versus one guy actually working
all
day. And
you know the billionaire's going to pay it back.
Well, you hope he
does. You know the corporation's going to pay it back. You don't know that these small businesses are going to be able to pay it back if we go into recession. So you have this really perverse situation where the banks, the big ones, only want to make loans to the big corporations. And in that situation, they can create as much money as they want. And that's why M2 is doing what it's doing, what we've been noticing for the last year. That's why it's growing at such a pace, because it is the Cantillon effect on freaking steroids. The Cantillon effect says the people who touch the money first benefit because they get this new money at a moment where prices haven't risen yet. And then once they make those purchases, those prices go up. They benefit from this.
So everybody go back, Trump, Biden, Trump, Obama, you name it, Bush, every one of those guys, you know, wasted their tongue talking about helping lower middle classes. And what Hal and I have just talked about in the last 10 minutes, if you don't get it, we'll talk about it again some other time. But the fact is, that has done more to screw middle class than anything those guys think they've done positively.
Well, think about this. If only the big corporations and the billionaires are getting the loans, and, you know, small businesses and small startups and whatnot, like we've been talking about, are not getting these loans, who generates all the jobs? These big corporations and these billionaires don't generate the
which
jobs
would you rather have,
that small businesses do.
Would you rather have one schmo sitting there giving three loans of $10 million apiece, or 15 guys pounding the table going visiting plumbing companies and electric companies and giving out those kind of loans? And you tell those guys, use your credit cards, and that's what they're doing, right?
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, it's really funny. I don't know if it's intentional, but my goodness, if you read Nazi economic policy, we mentioned this before, the Nazis wanted a few big, huge, massive companies.
It's the fascist economic system. Yeah.
And this is exactly what this does. If you don't like the Nazis, then we have a banking system
it was a German system, and they probably weren't the first.
Yeah, they probably weren't the first.
I mean, long before the Nazis. It basically, you define it somewhat, it's almost a plutocracy, but not quite. It basically says you want two or three companies in every industry, all with the nose up the ass of government, somehow tied into government.
Yeah.
And Hal, I've mentioned the story before, I'll give a 1 minute, and then we got to go to break. When I was in, we went over to Dr. J, myself, and another guy who was supposed, he came with us because he was supposed to speak German. All the guy could do is say, Ein Bier, and thank you. It was all he could say in German. He didn't know any German. His wife knew German. Anyway, he came with us. So we were lecturing on options in Austria and in Frankfurt. Credit Anstalt, and then it was dear departed Dresdner Bank, which is no longer there. And in Germany, I'm sitting there and I go, these guys, everybody's, there was no independent trader. Everybody's sitting at a desk at a bank. So if you're trading options, you're an employee of a bank, okay, which is not the same as on a trading floor trading your own account. I mean, I found it way less than exciting. But without going into all the details of the exchanges, how you could trade off the exchange and put the options on the exchange, which I thought was kind of weird. But I said, you know, this company you guys are trading, who owns it? And he goes, well, this bank owns 85% of the company. I go, wait a minute. You guys are trading options when one place owns 85% of the stock. Well, yeah. And I go, they can move it wherever they want. What are you doing? Anyway, but over there, the company, the big companies were all owned, not all, a lot of their stock was owned by the banks. And the banks had the nose up the ass of the government. So it was kind of one standard deviation away, where they not only had, the companies in terms of who was going to get what in terms of contracts, they had their finger on that pulse, but they also had a finger on the pulse of the bank that had all the money for these people. But everything was so tied together, and all the young people, it's getting like that here. I thought it would never get, this is 1991. I hope we're never going to get like that. The young people had no advancement whatsoever. I mean, you were always going to work for somebody else. Only if they really liked you or if your family was tied into the bank were you going to get all the promotions. It's starting to sound a lot like here, isn't it?
The funny thing is that whole system, that whole, it's a whole old European mercantilist feudal kind of system. And that is the system, not free market capitalism. That is a system that Marx railed against.
Yeah.
And if Marx was alive today, I guarantee you he'd be like me and you, railing against these institutions that just accrue power and wealth to a very small group of people. And this discovery about the capital requirements, what about the liquidity requirements? They have the liquidity requirements, the liquidity coverage ratio. Basically, you have to have a 30-day buffer of very liquid assets to handle a 30-day bank run, a bad 30-day bank run. You have to have enough. And
that's the money you're supposed
to.
If you weren't so damn big, you could borrow that money from the Fed. But now they're damn big.
But here's the problem.
We got a dash to break. Okay. Hold that thought, bud. SP futures down 27. The SP futures down 129. We come back here a little bit. Still got the VIX up 119, 23.57. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 29. NASDAQ Futures down 136. This is a way of review because these days are running together. Yesterday, S&P was down 61, NASDAQ down 192. So we're piling onto that. Kind of a bad last day. Europe, though, Europe and Asia are seriously whack here. DAX down 335, 1.5%. FTSE down 127, 1.3%. CAC round down 114, 1.4%. Over in Asia, this is where the real whackage is. Nikkei down 1,600 at 3.2%. The Hang Seng down 454, 1.7%. That's not as bad. Shanghai down 32.8%. So not good at all there. Oil up 17 cents. God, right where it is, 60.08. There's this 60 number. It's got like a magnet to it. Brent up 12 cents, 64.32, so not much going on there. Gold down 26 bucks, still over 4,000, 4,047. Silver out down 66 cents, 50.04. Is India has said that they imported like, I don't know, $1 billion worth of gold last quarter. So they've been a big gold buyer. That's why gold has been running up there. Not why, but one of the reasons. Foreign exchange. Dollar, a 9-month high against the Japanese yen. The yen is 155, so that's Japan fiscal policy, U.S. data in focus. The euro, 115.9, so that's pretty much unchanged. The pound, 131, unchanged from like yesterday. This, however, is news. Bitcoin, 91,370. It briefly fell before below 90,000, to lowest since April. So cryptocurrencies giving up their whole gain of 2025. Not a lot of good news there. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Bulls, somehow or another, after having a double to overtime night before, one last night.
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in Chicago. We're looking at 41 degrees right now with a high of 45. On and off rain and drizzle today. Breezy this morning. Tonight will be overcast with a low of 41 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 60 degrees right now with a high of 72. Mostly cloudy with a couple of showers and a thunderstorm. Any heavier downpours can lead to localized flooding. Tonight, cloudy with a couple of showers with a low of 56 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, we're looking at 33 minutes inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 53 minutes inbound Edens from Lane Cook, Eisenhower from Wolf, 46 minutes. We're looking at 68 minutes, Dan Ryan from 95th, and Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 46 minutes. Calgary Flames head down to Chicago today to face the Blackhawks at 7:30 p.m. We also had the Bulls beat Nuggets 130 to 127 yesterday, and today we got Suns at Trailblazers at 10 p.m. And finally, yesterday Cowboys beat Raiders 33 to 16, and this Thursday, November 20th, we got Bills at Texans at 7:15 p.m. Back to you guys.
Who did you want to win that game, Cowboys or Raiders? You want them both to lose or what?
Well, after seeing Staubach throwing to Drew Pearson on the sideline on YouTube, I was like, just watching the guys interact with each other, those old guys from the 70s, Staubach, Drew Pearson, and then the safety, Charlie something.
Yeah.
They're on the sideline just kind of like,
Charlie,
you know,
Waters?
They love each other.
Charlie Waters, wasn't it?
Yeah, Charlie Waters. Yeah, just seeing those guys interact at a time when, you know, we just came out of, like, Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And we had the tumultuous 60s and the Civil Rights Movement. Just seeing these guys interact like that just brought tears to my eyes. And so, you know, that alone is probably why I was probably rooting for the Cowboys. But I didn't watch the game.
I'm one of these guys that it's something that you could... We could argue about forever, right? Over copious amounts of alcohol. I think that with all the great quarterbacks you've had and the greatest of all time, the Tom Brady's, and people won all these Super Bowls, I have a feeling, and again, nobody can answer this, that if you threw all those guys on a practice field for 8 weeks, that Roger Staubach might come out the starter.
Yeah.
He was a Heisman Trophy winner in 63 at Navy. He should have won in 64, but John Heward from Notre Dame won. And he also was on the started on the basketball team and the baseball team.
Yeah.
And then he was in he did some service.
And he grew up in a time when you didn't really work out, you didn't really pay attention to your diet.
But he was pretty much a natural. And actually, a little bit of a story. One of the guys that was worked at Pullman with me, this guy named Bob Massa, terrific athlete. He was in the Air Force. And he used to play. He was on the Air Force softball and flag football all-star teams. So they would fly him around the country in like one of those old prop cargo things, just to get him to a game. So he goes. They had the best flag football team they ever had, and they were going to go down to play the Navy somewhere in Florida. And they got down there, and they were convinced that they were going to kick these guys' ass. And he says, all of a sudden, there's this guy on the other team. It's faster than everybody, and every time he threw a pass, it just kind of exploded on the guy's chest. And he goes, every one of these starters would not have played on our team, except there's this one guy. Finally, somebody goes, who the hell is that guy? The guy goes, well, that's Roger Staubach.
Wow.
Because he was playing on the flag football team when he was in the Navy.
Wow.
They go, he was absolutely a one-man gang.
Yeah.
He was the fastest guy.
Well, you know, it sounds like a lot like Danny Ainge. Danny Ainge was the quarterback on the football team.
Yeah.
I think he was a center on the basketball team. And he was like a point center at the time. And then my stepfather refereed one of his tournament games back in when he was refereeing high school basketball in Oregon. And then Danny also was a scratch golfer. And then the guy was also drafted in the first round to play third base for Toronto.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was playing for Toronto as a rookie. At third base. The guy was just a phenomenal athlete.
Who was that? Two guys in baseball, and then we'll come back to our banking stuff.
Yeah.
One of them was Jackie Robinson.
Yeah,
he was a record-setting halfback too at Southern Cal, wasn't he? And he played, and he played basketball.
Well, didn't he play at UCLA?
Oh, UCLA, yeah. And, yeah, I know it was one of the two. Then there was a guy on the Cubs.
Well, he ran track. He was a halfback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baseball was like his worst. It was like his worst sport.
Yeah.
But and then there was a guy in the Cubs. He was rookie of the year in 62-ish. A guy named Kenny Hubbs, a Mormon from Utah. And he next year he had a sophomore year. Then he was flying a private plane and crashed it and killed himself.
Wow.
But I went back and looked at him. He was recruited to Notre Dame and other places to play quarterback. And he was like an all-state basketball player.
Mm.
I mean, some of these people are just, you look at them and you go, I don't belong in the same field as these guys. You know, just, I was never, I had never had genes like that.
I think what kind of, what I love about Danny Ainge, not just because I was from Oregon and he was like a legend in Oregon. I just liked his, I'm going to freaking win. I mean, the guy just had this. No stage was too big for these guys.
Well,
like
he killed
Jordan
Notre Dame in the NCAAs. He just got one and dribbled the whole way and scored the final bucket.
Yeah, no stage is too big for these guys, and they just have this killer freaking instinct that you're freaking born with. And there are a lot of people who have God-given ability, like Ryan Leaf. But, man, the guy like Danny Ainge, he just got that killer instinct. He wants the ball to make the shot.
Yeah.
I remember watching the Portland Trailblazers when he was playing with, I think, Clyde Drexler. And Clyde got his second foul or his second technical foul. And Danny literally took over the game. And I think it was the reason why they won that game. I think it was against the Bulls. And he just had that killer instinct.
He knows other people's defenses. He knows where the weaknesses are.
Yeah.
And he's the first guy that taught me that if whenever you want, like, a last-second shot, just give it like to your best guy and just have him dribble right to the basket because nobody wants to follow him. He just goes right in.
Yeah, yeah.
I
think that quality is very rare in people.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Jordan has it. Staubach had it. Bradshaw had it. I mean, they're just a few guys that have this killer freaking instinct. And I'm afraid the guy from Buffalo, the quarterback from Buffalo, I'm not sure he has it.
Well, there's people that can keep – what was the old military term? Can keep their head about them when other people are losing theirs.
Yeah, like Joe Montana.
Yeah,
you know, in the Super Bowl, he's talking. He's like, you know what? You know when they get together in Bull Durham and they're talking about a wedding.
Yeah,
he's in a huddle. You know, everything's on the line, and the pressure doesn't affect him.
It does. You just deal with it. I mean, I had a professor in University of Chicago, and somebody said, "What does pressure do?" He goes, if you're good, pressure helps. If you don't, it hurts.
Yeah, yeah. Some people melt.
Yeah,
I think most people melt.
Well, some people don't. Ask the dumbest questions. When Ernie Banks died, one of the guys at the funeral was a Cub player at the time. He's an older dude, and the guy goes, "Well, when Ernie showed up, did you notice him?" He goes, first of all, he's the only black guy, so yeah, we noticed him. He goes, but he was also the fastest player on the team. They had the best arm on the team. And, oh, by the way, he was the best hitter on the team. How do we not notice him? How do you not notice a guy who's better than anybody else at all three things? Anyway, we're recursing the darkness here on this banking. I think,
it's
plus,
crazy,
you know what was missing from that?
It's bad.
You know what was missing from that thing you sent me that I was squinting to read? Was at some level, and I don't know where it is, so I shouldn't really say it, but at some level, if it's the Hallen Chief Plumbing Company and we've got five trucks and business is good, which means, you know, by the time there's money out there and we're waiting to get paid from people, so there's some float. And I think a lot of people have never had their own business. They don't live paycheck that get paid by somebody else, which is just about everybody. Don't have an understanding of how you can have a very good business and still be essentially broke. Because if you give somebody a bill and they don't pay it for 30 days, well, you got to pay people in the 30 days and you got to buy supplies. So most businesses don't go down because they're losing money. They go down because of cash flow. And a lot of times, if you have a project, you need...
That's why accounts receivable are bought and sold bonds.
Right. But you also need... If I get a plumbing job and I'm not going to get paid till February and it's going to cost me 3 months of labor and so forth, I may need a loan for that job, even though I'm making money the whole way. Now, the problem is if the guy at the other end doesn't pay, now we all got a problem. But let's leave that for tomorrow's discussion. But there's a lot of reasons why people need banking other than give me a loan because I got an idea. A lot of it is ongoing stuff.
Well, farmers need those operational loans.
Yeah.
Because they plant in the spring and they harvest in the fall.
Because when we did the, anyway, the finish, kind of the point I started, which I never damn finish, somewhere in this mess now, Dodd-Frank has, at some level, you and I having to sign over like our houses to get this loan. But somehow we've got to drop a personal guarantee on top of a corporation that's never not paid. Where you're not going to see Jeff Bezos making a personal guarantee or something.
Yeah.
Some, which really, really blows to be, because you know, you're going to go home to Mrs. Hal and she's going to say, you did what? You just put our house on the line? I mean, why do you have to do that? It's a corporation. They somehow are in there, they did everything they possibly can to screw this kind of normal borrowing. That's why when you, I mean, one of the reasons for, you know, I'll go back to, it's all the same subject, Hal, for God's sake. When I was doing a project, when I was working on the MBTA program, which I have still have to ride on those cars before they put them out of business. Anyway, it was a $60 million contract, which back in the day was a lot of money. But they didn't expect Pullman, even though Pullman probably could have, they had all kinds of banking lines, they didn't expect the bidder to put up any money. That was out of it. So what they did was, the day it was signed, they gave you 10%. When the undercurrent arrangement drawing, I think, was approved, it was another 5%. In other words, they gave you, they call them progress payments. They didn't expect you to have to go out and get the money and pay interest on it and add that to the cost of the project. They essentially financed it for you, which is a whole different program than if you're doing it yourself. Like if you and I are going to do plumbing for, you know, some new building going up, if the guy gives me the money up front to pay our people and to buy the whatever we need for the plumbing, that's number one. But if they don't, we better make sure that they've got some money. And, oh, by the way, we're going to need a loan to do it because no matter who we are, we can't cover 8 weeks' payroll.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, this is normal stuff that all of a sudden the thing you sent just brought this all to the front of my head saying that this is how we're screwing people because banks have no interest in doing that. Now, some small banks still do, but if you walked into, you know, Chase across the street, you're not, you and my plumber, I don't think they have any interest, do you?
Well, here's the thing about Chase is when we moved to Brooklyn a couple years, 3 years ago, you know, we thought, well, we'll go over to Chase and we'll move our checking account into Chase from a Utah bank. We go in there and guess what you have to have as a minimum balance just to be a customer at Chase? It's like freaking $10,000.
Really?
But if you're a veteran.
I think a Northern Trust here is like that.
Yeah. If you're a veteran, you don't have to have a minimum. So I was like, well, I'm a veteran. And so I got an account without having to maintain like a $10,000 limit or level. So they don't want regular folks as customers. They don't want regular folks as borrowers. And here's the even worse part. There's two parts to the banking regulation. There's the capital requirements we talked about, which provide this weird incentive to only lend to really riskless people. Really wealthy people, billionaires, and
they're riskless until they aren't.
And then there's the liquidity coverage ratio, and that is a requirement that banks have to have enough money to handle a worst case scenario 30-day bank run. And all that is instead of just having like reserves, they can have it in reserves, they can have it in treasuries, they can have it in mortgage-backed securities, and here's the other thing. They can have it in investment-grade corporate bonds.
Really?
Now, how is that a benefit to, like, these big, massive corporations? All of a sudden, it creates a demand that wasn't there before. So the demand for corporate bonds is a little higher than it was.
I thought the only bond that was the only stock was that was good capital was Fannie and Freddie Preferred. Where'd that go?
I don't know, but I mean, think about this. Now these banks can hold these corporate bonds as part of their highly liquid assets that can cover these bank runs, so that you create this artificial demand for these corporate bonds. When you increase the demand for bonds artificially, what happens to the price?
Well, yeah. So
it raises the price, and then it lowers the yield.
Okay, wait, what you just said...
Lower than it would have been otherwise.
What you just said, is that the reason why Citigroup didn't want OCC's $500 million overnight because they had to go get all this.
Maybe, I don't know.
It sounds like it.
It's just nuts that this is going on. Is it intentional?
Well, sure it is.
I'm getting to the point where it's just flat out intentional. And this is why the middle class is really getting screwed.
Okay, you know, you know, you just wandered here, don't you? My brother and I, as brothers do, we agree on just about everything, but we always have, you know, flashpoints. And he's convinced I'm a little too much on the conspiratorial side that, these are well-meaning people putting these bills and these regulations together.
I don't think so. I don't think.
You know what though? I'll say this for you. 5 years ago, you did. You're changing. Yeah.
Maybe they're looking up. They're trying to do good, but I don't think this.
Every time, what's been going on? I've been watching this stuff since I was in college. Every single time, the same people are winners and losers. It can't just be random chance. It's like flipping a coin and getting 12 heads in a row. I guess it's possible, but it's not very likely, is it?
Well, since the beginning, since the Constitutional Convention, where you had the Hamiltonians wanted a British-style government without the British king. They basically wanted to do what England did with a pope, where the king became the head of the church, the Anglican church. The Hamiltonians wanted a lifetime president. They wanted a virtual king. But they didn't want it to be the British king. They wanted it to be an American king. And they wanted the states to be just provinces. Those were the Hamiltonians. They're the ones that are essentially setting up the system we have today. They're the ones that are creating these banking regulations. This is an old Europe-style system that is somehow layered into our institutions in America. We still have this illusion of republic.
Yeah.
This illusion of the individual as sovereign. It's all an illusion. They've somehow turned our constitution into a old Europe style mercantilist feudal system.
They're doing it by regulation.
And they've been doing it for over 100 years.
Hal, can you give me me and the listeners. Now, a lot of what you're talking about, and again, we've talked about it bits and pieces on the show for years now, and it's just you know, it came together with the thing you sent me. Now in Illinois, Illinois, for those that don't know, people are listening, you know, wherever you're listening, Illinois was the last state to allow branch banking, which means one bank, one building, that was it. You could have a drive through on your property. That was it for up until 20 years ago, 25. I mean, it hasn't been that long. I mean, it's long if you're 25, but it hasn't been that long. So we are still, Illinois is still, I use the term blessed by, I mean, the stuff we read in these articles, and you and I know the difference between the bigger firms and little firms and how, but or we're trying to learn, let's put it that way. We still, if I walk out my door and want to walk a half a mile, there's seven banks. And across the street in the same building, there's a Burling Bank and there's a Lakeside Bank that are pretty independent, and there's a Chase over there or somebody, or one of those firms. And there's the Burling, there's another guy down the block. There's still all kinds of them in Illinois. And not as many as there were, but all kinds of them. And Kevin says in Southwest Michigan, sort of the same way. If you want a loan for your plumbing company, you can find it. There's all kinds of smaller banks here. Now, contrast that with, I think when I was in San Francisco, all I saw was Wells Fargo offices. I mean, the banks that allowed branch banking forever, what's the difference in the banking world in a state that maybe only has two or three banks versus Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, it just varies from state to state. But I do know this. The Federal Reserve was sold on this idea that we had too many bank failures in, 1907 or 1908?
Yeah.
And if you look at the bank failures before the Fed and bank failures after the Fed, it is nuts. To use the argument that the Fed is going to be, we need the Fed to be the lender of last resort. I have a chart in this class that I'm teaching today of bank failures, and it's freaking low. We're talking maybe 50 a year from 1892 through maybe 1917. Thereafter, it explodes to as high as almost 3,000 a year. And so the Fed, after it was instituted in 1913 to be the lender of last resort, did not do that in the late 19-teens and the early 1920s. It allowed 10,000 mostly rural banks, like the ones you're talking about in Chicago, in Illinois, to go under. And at the same time, the big New York City banks, They bought up all of those little banks,
yep.
made them branches. They increased their deposits. They increased their acquisitions, their branching. They got bigger. So the Fed is not the lender of last resort. The Fed, instead of being the lender of last resort, what I say it was? It was the creator of monopoly power. That's what it does. That's what the Fed does. It's 1984 Orwellian speak. The lender of last resort, it did not do that. It allowed banks to fail to make these big, powerful banks that own the Fed to become bigger and more powerful.
Well, funny you should mention that. We were at the... we used to clear through Mesro and PTI Securities, and it was one big happy family. And I tell you what, we were growing, we were doing great, you know, and we're doing good now. But it was a much better relationship than we have now. And they invited, it's 2008 sort of area, and so they invited me and my brother out. They're all their correspondents, or bigger correspondents, are having a meeting in Washington at the hotel right at the Hayes Healy or whichever one it is, right across the street from the White House. And it had a great bar down in the basement, and all the
yeah.
Where if you were a staffer from the White House, if you had to get back across the street, you could run right back. And if you saw some piece of news, or you had to get back.
I wonder if there's a tunnel, yeah. underground tunnel to it.
Maybe to the bar. It could be. And anyway, so I'm giving this speech. I wasn't the keynote speaker. This keynote speaker was a lady from Illinois. I think something Bean was her last name. She was a 2 or 3 term congresswoman. Very nice. I mean, she was an entrepreneur on her own and so forth. Just nice lady, and she, I never do this, Hal, although I do it to you just to piss you off if you're the professor. I actually raised my hand for questions twice, which I've never done in my whole career. And I said, this is back when we were having a crisis, and every weekend you're hearing about some bank that's having trouble, and the Fed is allowing Hal's bank, they'll go in, do an audit, say you've got, you know, $50 million of bad loans. The Fed was absorbing the bad loans, most of them, and kicking Hal's bank to Ricky for X number of dollars. And, you know, he'd have, you know, $100 million in deposits and 3 drive-in locations and blah, blah, blah. And I raised my hand and I said, you know, this is going on every weekend. I said, I happen to know your politics a little bit, and I think you would like to see more banks, not less. And I said, and she goes, well, absolutely. And I said, okay, but this is happening 2 and 3 times a weekend just in our area. I said, is there some group from your side of the aisle and the other side of the aisle that every once in a while from Congress sits down and, like, reviews the last 20 of these things? And she looks at me like I got 4 heads. She goes, why would we do that? I said, well, because some people are getting money and this thing is being punted to somebody else at a price that I'm not that big on the banking industry, but I'd pay that price. I said, I'll get a group of people together. Where do I get in the group that gets to bid for that bank? And she looked at me, she goes, well, you don't. And I, well, why don't I? why isn't this open bidding? I mean, last week, one traded for $50 million. They had like $1 billion under deposit, 3 locations. I go, you couldn't build one of those drive-thru for the money they just paid for that place.
Yeah.
And she looked at me, she goes, well, I guess I'll look into that or something. Does anybody check any of this shit?
She didn't look into it, I guarantee
you. Oh, I guarantee you that. No. But I mean, what if she found something out? What's she going to do with that information? Nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
So you're right. They'll tell you how they want more and more banks. Yet every time one goes as a little bit of a problem, they can't wait to kick it to one of their buddies at a ridiculously low price.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what did it do with mortgage-backed securities?
Yeah, well.
It put a price floor on them.
Well, yeah.
The TARP saved Goldman Sachs and all those executives that made really bad decisions. It allowed them to kind of ride those shorts out. Instead of somebody else owning Goldman Sachs, the people that made all those bad decisions, they maintained their ownership of a company that was making really dumb decisions, who were on the wrong side of the shorts.
Well,
and who enabled that? The Fed.
They didn't... I'm trying to remember, how did they... I don't think they specifically helped Goldman Sachs. I think what
they did, because they put a floor on those mortgage-backed securities.
Okay, but I think what they did
allowed them to run the clock out on the shorts.
They had a credit default swap or something. Yeah. Now, see if you can dig into the back recesses of your brain. They had some kind of a credit default swap problem with what's the huge insurance company?
AIG?
Yeah. And AIG was on the hook for a lot of money they didn't have.
Yeah.
And I think what the government did is gave the money to AIG so they could turn around and pay off Goldman Sachs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was intended to keep Goldman Sachs alive.
Yeah, but I'm saying, under current management. But I mean, nowhere are you going to find a check going to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
You're gonna,
well, but, yeah, I mean, come on.
I know that, but I'm saying.
That bailout.
But if they were to say, what do you mean? Show me a check we wrote to Goldman Sachs. It's not there, right?
The check doesn't exist, but that is the way that kept Goldman Sachs
did not
change ownership.
You and I know that. I'm just saying the way it was done was they essentially, because what we're talking about, because then we got a dash, is if you do an option contract through PTI or a stock thing through PTI, your account is held in an exchange. If Hal's on the other side of that transaction, the transaction is no longer with Hal. You're just long IBM calls or puts or whatever. So Hal's out of it. But when you do this other kind of stuff, it's like if you bet the Bears with Hal, and then the points move, and then I bet the Lions with Ricky, I'm not flat. I got two bets, right? I better make sure it's not like Ricky and Hal now pay each other, and I'm out of it. That's not the way it works. But these credit default swaps, they were with individual people. So you had what they call counterparty risk. And that's what happened to Goldman Sachs. They had counterparty risk because AIG was broke, right?
Yeah.
So the government paid off AIG, so Goldman Sachs got their money, or somebody like that, which is pretty sneaky. But
another part of that whole thing is the Fed was buying these mortgage-backed securities to put a price floor on them.
Without a doubt.
They put a price floor on these mortgage-backed securities. And that helped run the shorts out. That helped run the clock out.
And it's, some of them are probably still on a balance sheet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so how many classes are you teaching this week?
Well, I'm in this big macro section. It's huge. It's like 190 students. And I built this app.
Oh, God.
Because students will try to hack the attendance system. They're not in class, and their classmates sent them the code.
Why don't you use a Blackboard? You can't hack that.
But I built this app, Tom. It's really beautiful. I got to share it with you.
Oh, God.
You have to use a QR code on the PowerPoint. It doesn't open until I start the timer. And in the amount of time it takes to put your information in, you can't share it with your classmate who's not in class. It's beautiful. So I got this really cool app, man, and I built in like 2 days.
You could walk in and say, I've got this really cool app. It's called a Blackboard.
Well, you know, the dean wants the kids in the chairs, and if we didn't take attendance, it probably would be about 30% of the people in there, and that would upset the dean, so I built this app to make our dean happy.
God, you are an inventive soul, I'll say that for you. But, hey, thanks for that article. It strung together about five different subjects we've been talking about for years.
When I saw that last night, it just blew my freaking mind.
Yeah.
I'm about to turn it into a Mises article.
Well, hey, we'll talk to you next week, buddy. SP Futures down 26. SP Futures down 125. We've come back a little bit. So has the VIX. It's only up 126, not one more than that, but it's still 23.64. It's making me a little nervous. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.